All right, I am very grateful to the organizers for allowing me to speak here. I'm especially grateful to all of you for hanging around to listen to me. Actually, somebody pointed out this talk is actually from the future, so. let's get it out there. I'll attempt and maybe sell you a little bit on a, sort of a perspective on quantum mechanics that, in my opinion, sacrifice a little bit of completeness that you have with Hilbert space for a little bit more control. I don't expect you to give up Hilbert space, and there's a perfectly valid way of using it alongside Hilbert space for your everyday quantum systems, or you can think of it as a more basic, more primary way of looking at quantum systems than the Hilbert space, and I prefer that perspective a little bit when thinking about certain problems in defining observables in quantum gravity. It helps me a little. So one thing I've worked on as part of my graduate thesis was the problem of time. The problem with that is that it would take me a whole talk to explain why you should care about the problem of time as much as I. I will instead showcase this perspective in a more familiar setting, because instead of having two things that are unfamiliar, they'll just be the technique, and I'll talk about how it applies in a particular kind of a semi-classical calculation in ordinary quantum mechanics. And if time permits, I'll talk a little bit about why I think this is illuminating when trying to talk about the problem of time. So. I apologize. I don't have a lot of pictures to show, and as a theorist, I haven't developed a good way of talking without equations. Hopefully, the equations are all very, very familiar. So I'll try and make. I've put an effort to use only things that, mostly things that you've seen before, right? So I want to motivate my approach not from quantum, not starting from problems in quantum gravity, but just by looking at ordinary time evolution in quantum mechanics, right? So there's sort of two equivalent ways that in an ordinary quantum mechanics course you'd write time evolution. There's also sum over histories or path integrals, something like that. So this is not exclusive. So typically you either think about either the state as evolving or operators as evolving, and we have two and the equivalent conditions for their time derivatives. And we can use either one or even a bit of both, as you would in interacting field theory. You'd shift some of the Hamiltonian to the states, and some of the Hamiltonian would evolve your operators, and together you'll have an equation for the evolution of expectation values. So that looks a little bit like that. Of all three of those, this one is actually a bit simpler in a certain way, right? So this is an equation for a vector quantity, as some abstract vector in Hilbert space changes in time. This is a differential equation for an operator quantity that's even more complicated of an object. This equation sort of ostensibly looks like the thing on the left-hand side is a scalar, the thing on the right-hand side is a scalar. So this looks a little bit like an ordinary differential equation for some scalar quantity, and I'll call it a function that the operator A induces on the state of space, on the space of states. Right, so I'll use this sort of expectation value bracket to denote the function, right? So this function at each point in the state of space of states, it has a value, and this value I can find it. So what value this function takes on the state psi by taking the expectation value, right? This equation can be viewed as an ordinary differential equation in time for this function, just structurally. So bear with me a little bit, right?
Your A doesn't depend explicitly on the
function. Right. Oh, so actually, right here it could. Here, this works either in either, you know. Well, okay, so yes, A doesn't have explicit, right. A could evolve or state could evolve, but there's no explicit time dependence. Otherwise, I need another term. Correct. So, yes. Um, So this is in the sense in which sort of this is a function, this looks a little bit like an ODE, but it's not a closed ordinary differential system, because the right-hand side has a different function. It's the function that's induced by the commutator of A and H. So I need more functions of this sort to complete the system. Right? So suppose we sit down and we compute a bunch of commutators. So we're really interested in what the expectation value of observable A does over time. Right, so we compute it. We compute first commutator, second commutator, and so on and so forth. Right, and then we have a coupled system of ordinary differential equations in the functions that are induced by these operators on the status on the space of states. So, if your Hilbert space happens to be finite dimensional, then your operator algebra has a finite basis. And eventually the system will close. You'll have a finite system of ODEs in the place of a Schrodinger equation in the case of... So this is one, it's an entirely analogous way of writing down the Schrodinger equation for finite dimensional systems. Now, where I come from, working with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces is usually not all the rage. And so even for the Hilbert space of, say, particle on a line, this has some pathologies. There's some pathological properties that this system has. So first off, there are domain issues, right? A1, A2, A3, if they're operators on an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, their domains might not overlap or might not overlap on some state psi that I'm interested in. So I might not be able to evaluate these functions on some particular state all at once. Depending on what A is and what H is, the commutator might not be a very well-defined operator after some order. And if in the natural topology of the Hilbert space, these functions are not very nice, right? So if you look at the topology that's induced by the inner product on the Hilbert space, and near some wave function that's nice and smooth, there is always, in an open neighborhood of it, there's always some pathological functions with kinks and things that are not going to be in the domain of, say, A or A1 or A2. Almost, it's very rare, right? Unless your operator's identity or something really, 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 really nice. I can't think of too many. A lot of operators of interest are only defined densely, right? And so the functions that result are not going to be continuous in this natural sense. So you have a system that maybe you can't evaluate at every point, This is how I'm going to attempt to motivate why the shift of perspective that I'm going to talk about in a second. All right. So I want to try and make sense of this system of equations as a system of ODEs. So here's the main idea of the approach, and this most features are not entirely novel. And so there's a lot of algebraic methods and algebraic approaches to quantization. But the main players in the approach are some algebra A. It's an algebra of observables and the space of all linear functions on that algebra, right? So A must have its unit also. It must have the identity element. It would be a really poor set of observables if it doesn't. It has associative product. It's a complex vector space, and it has a star operation. So there is some notion of Hermitian conjugate. Don't think of it as the algebra of all possible operators on the Hilbert space. That's way too big, and operators on the Hilbert space, if you take the whole Hilbert space, don't form a very nice algebra for the reasons that I stated earlier. Think of it as a sort of a quantization of some classical algebra. Basically, it has to be large enough to such that its classical counterparts of the elements in this algebra can pinpoint to me the point in the classical phase space of my system. So for example, so I don't want to put every single tiny definition that you need to put there, but basically, if we're talking about 1D particle, right, one a possible algebra that you could go with, not the only one, is the algebra generated by x hat and p hat. So I have some abstract x hat and some abstract p hat that are subject to the canonical commutation relations. To populate this algebra, I take all possible polynomials in those two things, sort of modulo this commutator, and with complex coefficients, finite sums, finite products of all of these things, and then I'm also going to work with the space of all possible states, so all possible linear states on this algebra. So linear state, linear functional on the algebra is something that takes an algebra element and gives you a complex number. Okay, takes another one, gives you another complex number, and does it in a linear way. Right, complex numbers are a vector space, this algebra is a vector space, and so this linear structure is preserved by the math. An example of what could possibly work as such a linear functional is the expectation value. That is the motivation, right? So if my algebra does have a representation on some Hilbert space, right? And if I have a state psi that happens to be in the domain of all of my operators in this algebra, so in the case of 1D particle, you can have any any smooth function that falls off exponentially outside of some finite region, okay, that will be well defined for arbitrary polynomials in X and P. It will be normalizable, and you could assign an expectation value by square integration, right? Such an operation will assign me a complex number to every algebra element, and it will do it in a linear way, right? That's an example. Let's see a little bit more what this space gamma Q is. Just what sort of things are in it? Okay, so that's one type of thing that generates a member of this space. But there's also others, right? It's any linear assignment of numbers to operators. For example, trace, right? If we had a thermal state, we could take a trace. That's a linear assignment of a complex number, right? There's more pathological things. I could take and sandwich my operator between two states that are not the same, and that would also give me a complex number in a linear way. And in fact, this row doesn't have to be a density matrix. It just has to have a finite trace or, you know, summable, and it doesn't have to be Hermitian. Right, so this would still give me, so there are a lot of things that we would not normally consider states that can induce a linear function on this algebra. Moreover, if I have two of those things, I don't care where they came from, I can add them together and get another linear map. Right. I'm going to assume that I'm going to restrict myself to working only with the states that assign one to identity. Okay, so this is sort of equivalent to restricting to a plane that doesn't go through the origin, so it gives a kind of a plane it's not a subspace, it's an affine space inside. Since it doesn't go through the origin, it's not a subspace, but it sort of is a plane of sorts. Normally, in algebraic constructions like this, you also look for what's called to impose the positivity condition, which in the abstract algebra terms looks like this. So a positive linear state assigns a strictly positive number, or zero or positive number, to the combination of any element and its Hermitian conjugate. You can use this to derive things like uncertainty principle, triangle inequalities, and so on, the analogs of that. You can use this, if you impose this, you're guaranteed to get a real number as an expectation value of a Hermitian observable. Okay, so sometimes I do not impose that. For regular applications, if I'm talking about an ordinary quantum system, I'll want to enforce this as well. So this thing does have tangible links to Hilbert space, right? So as we You know, and you can treat as an auxiliary tool. If you have a favorite Hilbert space you want to work with, you have the states that you like in your quantum system, you can always impose restrictions on the functionals that they have to be realizable at some state in that Hilbert space that you're working with. Okay? You could also take a purely algebraic view and use what's called the Gelfand-Neimark-Segal construction. If you find a positive linear functional on a star algebra, you can construct a Hermitian representation of it. In some sense, this space contains the seeds of all Hilbert space representations of the algebra we're talking about. And at the same time, it's a little bit smaller. Yes?
Can you help me figure out, so when I think of the Hilbert space, I think about the linear structure.
Right.
But I also think about the topological structure to make sure that I have the, you know, the Cauchy sequences.
There is no,
is not a Hilbert space.
No, it is not a Hilbert space, it's a complex vector space.
Does it have any natural topology?
Well, a complex vector space topology, just sort of the weak kind, I guess, the regular kind. If you pick one of these guys and you could use it to Cauchy complete a certain subsector of it and create a Hilbert space within it, but you'll have to add a bunch of things. So this thing is missing. What this thing is missing are states that are maybe on the domain of one of the algebra operators, but not on the other. It's missing a whole bunch of things that Hilbert space does have. At the same time, it has all these extra things that the Hilbert space doesn't have. So this might look like a waste of time to you. It's just it depends on what you're trying to do with it, right? So but it does have these links to Hilbert space, right? You can any state that's a good state for all elements of my algebra can be used to assign values to operators in this way. So the reason I'm sort of raving on about this gamma Q is that it has a structure of a phase space in some sense. Okay? What do I mean by that? So first of all, right, this is what it was designed to do. It was designed to be the home of functions that are associated with my with elements of my algebra A. So I've only picked the states, the things that live in gamma Q are precisely the things that assign a value to every one of my elements A. So as a consequence, every element A creates a function on that space. Okay. Moreover, these functions completely resolve the space gamma Q. Right. What is a linear state on some algebra? Well, if I tell you what value it assigns to each one of the elements of the algebra, I've completely specified the state. If I know the values of all these functions, I can pinpoint where in this gamma Q I am. There is also a more fun structure that's more phase spacey. There is a Poisson bracket. It's a true Poisson manifold. Yeah, so there, if you pick two of these functions that originally were induced by elements of my algebra, you can take a bracket between two of them, define it through the commutator of their original algebra space where they lived. Okay, this can be extended to a true Poisson structure on it. So this is like a quantum phase space, and though, because it has to do with the commutator, this Poisson bracket also has to do with time evolution. Okay, so here's kind of the punchline. Why bother with all of this? Well, because it makes this quantum system look decidedly classical. I mean, it doesn't get rid of, there's still quantumness there somewhere. But if we take this as the definition of how a state evolves, right, the derivative of expectation value of A is the expectation value of the commutator with some distinguished element, the Hamiltonian, then this is nothing other than this quantum Poisson bracket between the function induced by A and the function induced by H. So this precisely follows from this definition. And so more generally, any function on that space gamma Q, the quantum phase spaces, I'm just going to refer to it like that from now on, evolves according to this kind of Poisson bracket type equation. So what we have is we have some distinguished algebra of enough observables for your purpose, let's say P and X and their and polynomials that you can construct from them. The space of all linear states on that algebra, and the state, so gamma, the space gamma Q comes equipped with a Poisson bracket where evolution is given by evolution induced by a Hamiltonian is given by a Poisson bracket of the Hamiltonian function with whatever function you have in that phase space. Now, if we go back at sort of our original motivation, right, so this is what this was designed to do, and it did maybe a little bit extra, and, it of course has some shortcomings, but now this set of differential equations, suppose H and A are both in this algebra that I picked. Then so should be their commutators, right? If it's algebraically close, so should be all of their commutators. And so any state in gamma Q, by definition, has to assign a value to these functions. And in the, in the topology of the vector space topology of gamma Q, these assignments are continuous. They're linear, so they're continuous. And so we have a set of differential equations that's guaranteed to be defined at each point of the space, right? So there are various situations where you might want to use this thing, okay? And I have used it in various places, and I'm hoping there are more applications for this point of view. So let me give you an example, right? So we have this infinite system. How could you solve this? How could you solve an infinite number of coupled ODEs? Well, maybe the system decouples into finite subsystems. It's possible, right? If I have 10 equations and 10 variables that don't depend on the rest of infinity of variables. Maybe there's also, depending on the states you pick, depending on your Hamiltonian and so on and so forth, there could be a perturbative way to truncate this into a finite system or do perturbation theory formally. All right? Yes?
So I might have missed it in the definition, but mm-hmm. From the title, it's like you've gotten rid of the Hilbert space in some sense by assigning the function.
Right.
But sort of what I didn't get was, did those functionals encode superpositions? It seemed like your last example was, but otherwise, if you just had the addition of two functionals.
Right, they're not, right. The addition does not encode superposition. There would be some more complex operation. So you would probably want to really talk about superposition, you would probably want to include in your algebra operators that take you, that some unitary transformations take you from here to here, for example. And then so you could look at coherence between two points or something like that. But yeah, this, by itself, it doesn't solve all your problems, right? So it does require some fine-tuning. So let me show you how you can make like a brick out of this, right? It's a pretty blunt instrument. I'm going to talk about applying this. Oh, by the way, before I go further. So I was talking about time evolution, but of course there's nothing special about that unitary transformation. If you have some other unitary transformation generator, you can also do it via Poisson bracket on this space, right? If you have not a Hamiltonian, but angular momentum operator to generate rotation or something else, you would end up constructing a very similar system. Here's how you turn it into a hammer. So I'm going to pick a very simple definition of what a semi-classical state is. I'm not going to worry about how thermal it is. I'm not going to worry about coherence. I'm just going to focus on spread, how spread it is over phase space. Right, so I'm going to talk about a particle on the line, but this semi-classical expansion at least can be extended to at least any sort of finitely generated algebra. So if you are quantizing, a sphere or something like that has a different basic set of coordinates, you could also give some meaning to this. So for a 1D particle, right, a token state I'm going to use is a Gaussian, right? It can be narrow in both. Well, it is. Depending on what you mean by narrow in your momentum and your position space, it can be narrow in both, depending on the problem you're trying to solve, right? So the spreads are limited by the uncertainty relation in the real space. In the space that I'm talking about, uncertainty relation pops up if you impose this positivity condition that I mentioned. You can't violate that. Maybe a pedantic point, I'm going to say things like, you know, spreads are of the order of h-bar or something. So in order to do that, you need to rescale your units. And so what the sensible way of doing that is, it depends on your situation. You need some notion of how much spreadiness in position you want to trade off for spreadiness in momentum. So you can do it via some sort of a rescaling in natural units. So we're thinking about what a semi-classical state would look like on this gamma Q phase space. The natural basis for describing this is not to look at the expectation values the state assigns to position, position squared, position cubed, and so on, but to look at what it assigns to nonlinear functions like the standard deviation. So position squared minus square of position, and so on and so forth. Same thing for momentum. So there are so-called generalized moments. So there are nonlinear combinations of these functions that are assigned by P and X and the polynomials. And so they look like this. This is a little bit of algebra and combinatorics. If you don't go too high in A and B, or you don't have too many degrees of freedom, it's not too bad. It can get pretty intense. So the operators here, the P and X, don't commute. I'm assuming there's a symmetrized ordering. The reason for that is that when I choose my variables this way, they have some nice properties. So these are functions on gamma Q. They're instead of the functions induced directly by my observable algebra, right? So they have the following properties. Together with just the plain expectation value, so if I have expectation value in X, P, if I have standard deviation in X, standard deviation in P, their covariance, and all of the higher moments, I can pinpoint where I am in gamma Q. Okay? They're exactly equivalent to saying what they assign to some basis of polynomials. There's a one-to-one relation. And in fact, there's kind of a nice formula if you have a totally symmetrized polynomial. You want to write it in terms of these guys and these guys. What you get is, as your leading term, so to speak, you get pure classical polynomial in just the expectation values, and then you have a sort of a Taylor expansion in these generalized moments. So if I make these generalized moments smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, of course there are some uncertainty relations that limit how much I can do this, but suppose I can force them to vanish relative to some scale, I'll just be left with this classical-like assignment. So if I would be able to parametrize each point just by expectation value of X and expectation value of P. So I'm going to assume that in a semi-classical state, there is a drop-off in the expansion, in the powers of H bar. Okay, as I get higher and higher in the order of these moments, so the order of moment is the sum of the orders of X and P inside of this expression, I'm going to assume that they follow this hierarchy in square root of H bar, really, not H bar directly. And if I evaluate these moments on the rescaled Gaussian, the Gaussian that's been adapted so that the two standard deviations are both, you know, h bar by 2 or something, in the rescaled units, I get this, which exactly follows this assumed hierarchy. So there are real wave function states that follow this, right? The real wave function states that correspond to a point on gamma Q that have this. So there's my tangible link. So I'm going to assume that this makes sense.
What about a Hermite times a Gaussian?
You'd have to calculate what it is to arbitrary order, but it would be very, very surprising if it suddenly has a different order behavior. basically, if I now write my dynamical equations using this new set of variables, so again, I'm still talking about particle on the line, I can write what d by dt is for each of the expectation values of x and p, and then for these moments that I construct. I'm not going to worry what couples to what, that depends on what the Hamiltonian is. I'm just going to write them down in the increasing order, right? So the idea is, very crude, I'm going to drop everything that is of order n, where n is something, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Don't go very high because the number of terms explodes. But I'm going to drop everything that's of this order, right? And if I have a composite product of some function, some other function, h bar to some power, I just add up all their orders. And h bar carries a power of 2. So I'm going to drop all of this, I will see what remains of my system. And there's a key result that's general that doesn't depend on what Hamiltonian you have. So key result is basically that on the space of certain class of algebras of this kind, including this one of a particle on the line, the Poisson bracket between a pair of functions, the order of that is bounded from below by whatever the highest order is of f or of g. So, for example, this delta x squared is an order 2 function in the semi-classical expansion. And so I don't need to know what the Hamiltonian is to say that the order of the Poisson bracket on the right is going to be at least 2, right? If I have a fifth order variable, its time derivative is at least of fifth order. And so this result guarantees that I will truncate this system to a finite number of equations, right? And moreover, it always gives me a finite system. It doesn't give me extra algebraic relations from the equations, right? If I just had something here vanish but not something here, I'd have an additional constraint. Or I drop this, and there's this part is does not get truncated. I don't get any of those in this case. As a result of this, the Poisson bracket can be taken before or after the truncation. And after the truncation, it's much easier, right? If I have some Hamiltonian function and it has some terrible Taylor expansion with 20 terms, but I only care about order 3 truncation, I can drop all of that and then use this to generate the equations that I need. Yes? That's which order you can drop. That's a gray area. Are the things of higher order really small in the case of the state that you're considering, right? So, and they might grow dynamically. So there's this is not a magical cure at all, or it's a pretty pretty blunt thing. Yes.
But if h is quadratic.
Yeah.
It will automatically truncate, right?
Which
is p squared and x squared.
Right. If h is quadratic, this algebra closes. And so for a harmonic oscillator, this is, you get the decoupling that I was talking about, right? So these two equations, without anything that I need to worry about, decouple from the rest in that case. This result I kind of talk about in this paper if you're interested. So here's an example that this just looks a little, like it's in a silly notation that I did way back during my graduate thesis research. So sort of ignore the strange names. This model was this is really a square root of harmonic oscillator. So it's a slightly, very, very slightly non-trivial system. And so alpha is just the kind of position. P alpha is its conjugate momentum. There's nothing, no funny business, right? So E is, twice the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian. I'm taking the square root of that. I can solve this using my, using standard quantum mechanics techniques, right? I know that H and E have the same eigenstates, except that the eigenvalues that H assigns are square root of the eigenvalues of the harmonic oscillator. This, as you might imagine, ruins certain kinds of coherent behavior of the harmonic oscillator. which is, you know, kind of fun. I could also do it using my, you know, truncation method, truncating everything after order 2. And, you know, there's practical reason for that. The number of degrees of freedom grows as n factorial. So I have, at order 2, I have 5 degrees of freedom. I have the 2 expectation values, and I have spreads in each variable and the covariance delta alpha p alpha. And I can expand the Hamiltonian. It's, for practical reasons, easier to expand in E, so you don't worry about ordering of operators in your Taylor expansion. But this is, you know, it's fairly well defined. And so I can expand this and truncate it in to second order, and then compute dynamics via this Poisson bracket. So do exactly, you know, what I was talking about here. Do that to second order. Right, so first the wave function I pick. So I did not set out to study the parameter space. So this is, you're just going to see one state that I've evolved. So, you know, think what you may about how this generalizes. Right, so I have one case in which this is not completely insane. I start with an initially Gaussian state, and if you have a regular harmonic oscillator, it would go back and forth without changing shape. Right, but this is a square root harmonic oscillator, so if you plot the wave function, the square amplitude of the position wave function, so this is space, this is time, it bounces, it sort of stays a little somewhat narrow, and then it just spreads and goes into, you know, the different modes don't have the same oscillation frequency, it sort of spreads out. In my truncated system, I only have 5 degrees of freedom. I can't compete with that. But, you know, to do this, I had to sum over, for this state, sum over about 100 eigenstates for, right, I diagonalized my Hamiltonian, I summed over something like 100 eigenstates, and then, so this was sort of a state sum method. I didn't numerically evolve this. It's much, much simpler numerics here, potentially. What I can keep track of is the 5 degrees of freedom that I kept, and I can compare what happens, right? So for this Hamiltonian, this is a phase space trajectory, right? So classical trajectory for square root Hamiltonian, square root harmonic oscillator is still circular, it still goes back and forth. But because, you know, as your wave function spreads, the period of orbit differs. It's not the same for, it depends on where you are. You get some kind of a distortion. And so this solid line is what I get from just using the wave function. And this dashed line is what I got by using this 5-parameter ODE system. Okay, and so you can see that, you know, for a while, so clearly after the two trajectories separate from the classical one, they're better matched together than to the classical trajectory. So it seems to capture the phase space behavior, but it's sort of hard to see this as a very, very small deviation. So what's more instructive is to track how the spreads and covariances vary, right? I can compute standard deviations in using both wave function and using this truncated set of degrees of freedom method. And they match fairly well, so this was evolved for a time of, well, I say up to 5 alpha naught, so alpha naught was the scale of my model. So this goes up to 4 alpha naught. And so you see that the dashed line is the truncated solution, the solid line is the wave function method. So they're fairly closely matched. They reproduce sort of non-trivial features of getting narrower, getting wider. And then this line is sort of an arbitrary kind of my measure of where you could say that your spread is big. Yes? Order 2, so h-bar. So I included terms of order h-bar, and that's nothing higher. So, I mean, it's actually much easier to explore parameter space using my 5D sort of truncated system than using the wave function, right? If I pick something that's not Gaussian, something that, like what Nate suggests, it would, you know, I'd have to decompose that state, right? So I have this, I can look up in, you know, QM textbook. If I want a different state, I'd have to do it by hand. It would add extra computation, and it could be complicated. So, you know, there's something to be gained. How am I doing on time? Should I stop? So this is my semi-classical thing. If there is more, What's the opinion on time? Is everybody ready to bolt, or?
Maybe there are questions now before you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in Connect's matter, when we try to solve a theory which becomes very complicated in quartic and quadratic variables, we do something called an equation of motion approach.
Okay.
We take the operator, do the ddt of that operator.
Right.
And you generate the commutators of these through a Baker Campbell Hausdorff.
Okay.
Eventually, you choose such that the first linear term vanishes and only the quadratic degrees of freedom remain behind.
Okay.
I'm just looking at it formally.
Looks a little, I'm not familiar, but
so Green's functions, right? You can write down equations of motion for Green functions. X operator there, let's say.
Well, is it? Is it the green? Like the XX operator is just this. Right.
But I mean,
it might have something to do. There are people who were trying, work on this in field theory setting, and I think the link there is closer to condensed matter. This is sort of ordinary QM system, so I don't know.
Yeah, I was just curious.
Yeah.
It's very much like an equation of motion approach.
Okay.
Operator.
I have.
It's a single particle. Operator.
Yeah.
But in field theory, you write down ddt of psi dagger.
I'm not familiar, but that sounds like, yeah. I'd be curious to see. Yes.
Well, and before you're going to move on, can you compare this to the other sort of Gell-Fonck construction, the Gell-Fonck triplet or the ring?
Yeah.
Right, because that in that one, for example, like you have the a x hat to the a, p hat to the b. Instead of to solve the domain problems from these kinds of dynamic problems there, you say, I'm not going to consider my whole Hilbert space, I'm only going to consider the space of tempered distribution.
Yeah, you could do that.
Yeah,
I mean.
So how does this compare? Because that's a different sort of approach to sort of make these things.
So all tempered, I don't think it's completely different.
Right.
If you look at a pre-Hilbert space, right, this is probably something that's closest to what states are, that correspond to things in this gamma Q. So this gamma Q is bigger if you have two different pre-Hilbert spaces for something. They don't communicate, but both would be included in values you can assign to this. So yeah, I mean, in these constructions, you start with something similar. You start with an algebra, you find a positive linear functional that you're happy with, and then you construct a pre-Hilbert space, then you take Cauchy completion. Like this, I don't necessarily have the intention to go this far with any of the states that I have. Yes?
I was just going to mention that, many things, I guess, one could go off here, but if you took the previous slide for the wave function and constructed the Wigner function for it, you would get in phase space this picture, and then every time you see the little wiggles, you're going to get these. Every time a bit of one part of your phase space linear function has another piece on the other side, you're going to get these fringes.
Okay.
And so what your classical thing should get is you should get all the blobs, but none of the fringes at some order. And this is precisely due to that you're sort of ignoring the superposition effect in some sense. So I can show you there's pictures people have studied for the double well where it looks really crazy. But this is sort of a nice one where you probably could understand it.
Okay.
I'm sorry, what is Z in this case?
Z is a complex number that depends on your starting position and momentum, on where this starts off and how fast it's moving, basically.
Okay.
So the real and complex parts of Z, I'm just kind of going to make up, but they have something. I want to say that real part of Z is position, and imaginary part is momentum, let's say, of the center of mass of the Gaussian. They're just kind of a little, right. They have to do with the initial values of the expectation value of alpha and p alpha, right? So where do I start? Here's an example, right? of what I did with this. If you indulge me for a few more minutes, I'll just say a couple of words about the problem of time. So I like to, you know, look a little bit past Hilbert space because of some issues in, you know, constructing a quantum theory of gravity. So as Sean mentioned, I'm not going to go into any kind of detail. If you sort of need in. All right, depending on the kind of space you have with, but generally, the total energy of your Hamiltonian general relativity is constrained to be zero. Classically, right? So if you write a Hamiltonian for general relativity, you also have a condition that it must vanish. If you sort of, how would you set energy to zero if you were doing quantum mechanics? Well, you'd solve some sort of an eigenfunction, some sort of an eigenvalue equation like this. So this is my what's called Hamiltonian constraint. I would look for things that are in the null spectrum of it, right? But if I have this restriction, all of my physical, so to speak, physical states, all of the states that satisfy this restriction are in the null eigenspace of my energy operator, my Hamiltonian. Where is d by dt psi, right? So how would I, if you have a wave function that is in the null eigenspace of your Hamiltonian, it doesn't evolve. You know, some sort of this general idea is where time is relational in some way. It's encoded in relations between co-evolving degrees of freedom. Okay, so how can this work in quantum theory? So this is sort of a parable, a tale, and it's a very instructive tale of the parametrized particle, right? So just talking about this a little bit. So this is my kind of. Yeah, whenever I'm thinking about it, this is often the first system I think, well, does it work for it, right? So if I have back to particle in 1D, right? This is the Schrodinger equation, there's some Hamiltonian, you know, that's a time evolution equation. If I write it like this, all of a sudden it looks like a constraint equation, right? But none, you know, it doesn't seem like anything has changed. I moved everything on the left, and now I have some operator acting on the wave function that should give me zero, but there are some subtleties, right? We don't normally think of the, you know, of this as an operator on the wave function. This, you know, the d partial d by partial t. So wave function psi of xt, you know, with the way we think of it in ordinary quantum mechanics, it's a one parameter sort of a one parameter family of functions of x. Right, the parameter is time. So at each different time, I have a normalizable function of x. So this is where this belongs in this equation. If I'm talking about the constraint, remember there is no d by dt. So this whole thing would be my energy. If I go back to sort of this picture, right, this whole thing would be my energy. So things there are all physical degrees of freedom, right? Consequently, this is not some d by d parameter, this is an operator, this is the conjugate momentum of time, so to speak. So this psi should really belong, if these are all self-adjoint operators, psi should belong to the space of functions that are square integrable on x and t, right? Well, since the solutions are the same, right, solutions of these two, these are PDEs, their solutions are the same. We know that the solutions to this equation are not square integrable on the xt plane, right? They're unbounded in time. The particle can move back and forth, it can deform, but it doesn't die out in the t direction. So this wave function doesn't even belong to the same space that we start off with in some sense. It's sort of lost. It really is a distribution. So the idea is to try and reverse this process a little bit. Given some constrained equation like this, can you write it like that? That's one tentative idea. Can you find a degree of freedom that you can demote to being a parameter and from being an operator? That involves a change to the inner product structure so that you can write your constraint as a time evolution equation. That's, you know, it's not the only idea out there, but this is certainly the one that is, you know, I guess most conservative in my opinion. So right? This guy, while, you know, the solutions to this equation, while they're not states on the XT wave function space, they are distributions on it. So if I find something that's normalizable with respect to X and T, and I multiply this by a solution of this, I can integrate this, right? So they're well defined, so to speak, bras, and if they're paired with a suitable ket, they can assign values to operators on this space. And, you know, if this is particle on the line, the four basic operators, I can, I'd say there's T, X, and their conjugate momenta, right? So a solution to this, if I find a suitable ket, can still assign values to these four operators. So it still lives in some sense in this gamma Q space. It's linked to some points in this original space. Even though I'd have to change Hilbert spaces in going from here to here, the distributions on Hilbert space that will form the basis of my solution already kind of live in this guy. And this is my 5 cents on the problem. This is kind of the stuff that I'm thinking about. This is my motivation for not looking exclusively on Hilbert space, but looking at these algebraic structures. Thank you.
More questions?
Could you say again what the Poisson bracket you referred to and how it's defined?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's really a straightforward idea, right? So I just, a Poisson bracket between a pair of functions that are induced by two algebra elements is just the function induced by their commutator. This does satisfy Jacobi identity. It can be extended if you use Leibniz rule and product rule, what have you. If you require it to be bilinear and so on, this gives you a true Poisson bracket on this space. And it's actually a degenerate Poisson bracket. It doesn't have an inverse. So it's not exactly a symplectic manifold.
This is a strange question. So if you wanted to go back to Hilbert space,
yeah,
and you use this Poisson bracket, and then you try to quantize it.
Does that so make second any sense quantize at all? This?
Yeah.
You could try that. I've never tried it. So you could restrict. So you could restrict to something that is symplectic, and then do something. Yeah. It's not clear to me why I do that, but it's not. Yeah, it could work.
It's also a question whether you can define a problem that the alternative approach works better, right, rather than reproduces like some of your curves. Have you found the killer problem? or any problem where it works better than just doing the Hamiltonian formula?
I haven't actively. So the short answer is I haven't actively looked for it. It's in my, it's one of these dreams that I haven't actively pursued. Like I'd love to see someone who says, hey, you know, there's this kind of calculation that's problematic that this might work better for. There might be something like that out there. I don't know.
And this is a kind of different question, but stimulated by some of the same considerations. When Fred was talking about the wiggles and lumps, mm-hmm. It reminded me of pictures in movies that I've seen of the Bohm interpretation. There's a sense in which David Bohm takes very seriously, to my mind, somewhat unrealistic, actual micro trajectories and calls them unobservable reals, so to speak. Each particle starts somewhere in, say, a Gaussian shape and is affected by a quantum potential in addition to the actual potential. When you go to a barrier, for example, the particles in the front end of the packet sit on the top of a very fringy, fingery quantum potential that rises up suddenly as the packet approaches the barrier and lifts the ones in the front, and the same fingery type structure sinks the ones in the back while the packet is spreading. And there are some very, very realistic features, because it's also true that an ordinary Gaussian will separate by the dispersion of free space and have wiggles in the front, or at least in complex numbers, and contain the faster moving particles. So for him, the microtrajectories that are in the front of the packet get assisted by the quantum potential to go over, and they make it. You can see movies of that. You can see movies of the two-slit interference if you look carefully enough and you're ancient enough to remember where to look. But these seem to be very, very different fringes that are real in a different sense, and yet there's a similarity of trying to get something close, semi-classical, if you like. Mm-hmm. Have you seen those movies, and do you know how they relate to what you're doing?
Okay. I have not. I should.
They're interesting. Look at it, but yeah. The bad things for Bohm mechanics are the sum of the Coulomb potential and the quantum potential, which is a completely flat table, giving you no clue as to why the atom has the size it has, or why the microtrajectories, as I call them, would be distributed in anything like a Gaussian wave function.
So I have one question. Mm-hmm. It's on your last thing about removing time.
This one?
Yeah. So just sort of, I don't know, I guess, just thinking philosophically, demoting one parameter or not another and so forth, do you have any thoughts about what might single out that we, I don't know which way you want to think about this, in which direction, but why time should be treated differently from space in this mapping? I mean, or is it your suggestion to go to this language in which time is not treated differently from space?
Yes, that's precisely that. Yeah. In here, so my kind of very naive hope is here, you could think of going by, you know, calling T the parameter, that solution sort of lives there, or the seeds of that solution live there, or you could pick something else, they're all there. And that they would be related by gauge transformations of some sort that preserve physical information, or they will be lie on some equivalence class of this space. So that's kind of the idea.
So do you have, and you know, this is obviously this sort of level of sort of an idea that's still nascent, but do you have any sense of why it would be that you start with this fundamental structure in which time and space are kind of on an equal footing in the sense of they're both operators and it's, you know, L2 functions on R2, why we are drawn towards an equation in which time is demoted rather than space is demoted, and what that happens to work, the other doesn't. Any thoughts on that, or is that too far beyond?
No, I don't know. That's, I mean, that would require something where, you know, time and space are treated as, you know, real in some realistic way, where I encode the timeness of time in some way and the spaceness of space. So maybe if I did shape dynamics with this, that could give me some more of a clue why one degree of freedom is set. So there are people, and I think Julian Barbour and some collaborators think that there is a distinguished degree of freedom that is time, and somehow it, I should read more about what they say, but that it does come out of shape dynamics, that one of them is. The way I was approaching this is I was trying to be as democratic as possible, where all degrees of freedom are treated on the same footing. Any one of them can serve as time, and it, you know, shouldn't matter. But it does have an effect on, you know, if you demote one thing to a parameter, there is no observable associated with it. You have one Hilbert space structure, you have one set of observables. If you demote a different one, now that one that was time, now that's an observable operator, and then some other thing is a parameter. There's some strange side effects of thinking about it that way. Are they realistic? I'm not sure.
Any more questions? Well, then let's end by thanking Arthur once again.